This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Today in Questions in Economic Policy, how do you isolate an already isolated regime? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 17th day of August. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. We start big picture today, some macroeconomics, both here, the American economy, and overseas, Afghanistan, and that economy, and what might come next with the Taliban in charge. As I say all the time on this program, here, the consumer is in charge. What we buy and how much of it we buy is pretty much the whole economic deal. So it was with some concern this morning that the July retail sales report came in showing a 1.1% drop last month. But as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains, you got to read the fine print.
So the obvious explanation for this drop in sales would be the Delta variant and the idea that it's making people stay home again to protect themselves. Ted Rossman at creditcards.com is not convinced.
I'm not sure that the Delta variant is really the biggest reason here.
Because the retail sales report includes sales at bars and restaurants.
And they actually grew a little bit from June to July. Not as fast as they had been growing previously, but still, people are getting out there.
It's not that Delta isn't a factor at all. I mean, a lot of people thought they were going back to the office this September, or that their kids were going back to school in person. And for some, that's not happening, which could be why sales of clothing dropped. But Rossman says a bigger issue is likely inflation.
Consumer demand is not unlimited. It does seem, and a lot of this is anecdotal, but it does seem that when people are faced with higher prices, something has to give.
One category in particular dragged down the numbers: car sales. Dana Peterson is chief economist at the Conference Board.
There's this big chip shortage. So cars need computer chips. And if you don't have those chips, then you can't build the cars. And so many retailers only have the available inventory that's on the lot. Otherwise, their customers have to wait months to purchase a car.
And yeah, prices on cars are rising because of all this. As always, we've got to put these numbers in context. Sales were down 1% last month, but they were still almost 16% higher than in July 2020. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Okay, Afghanistan. And this comes, as most reporting about this story does right now, with the "it's early days yet, and a whole lot of things are still in flux" caveat. But this item did catch our eye. The head of Afghanistan's central bank has fled the country. The United States has cut off the bank's access to its reserves being held here, and Washington may yet wind up trying to isolate the Taliban from the entire international financial system. But, and again with the but, how is that going to work if other countries, Russia and China in particular, are still willing to deal with the Taliban? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that one.
The last time the Taliban was in power, more than 20 years ago, the U.S. imposed strict sanctions on financial dealings with them. And you still can't trade with them or provide services.
You can't buy them a cup of coffee.
Brian O'Toole is a former sanctions official at the Treasury Department, now at the Atlantic Council. He says it's not clear yet how strictly the Biden administration will enforce those sanctions.
If the Taliban come in and are quote unquote, kind of reasonable up front, right? They're not stoning people in the soccer stadiums right away kind of thing. You know, you could see a scenario in which the U.S. is not as interested in enforcing sanctions.
But if the Taliban is not reasonable, the U.S. could enforce the sanctions to the letter and apply them to anyone under U.S. jurisdiction. O'Toole says that could include banks that exchange currencies through the U.S. Federal Reserve System. Warren Coates is a retired International Monetary Fund official who's advised Afghanistan's central bank for about 20 years. He says even with the threat of sanctions, China is interested in doing business with Afghanistan.
10, 15 years ago, when there were mineral development and extraction projects, the Chinese were quite interested.
Coates says China didn't invest in Afghanistan's rare earth metals then, but that interest didn't go away. Rachel Ziemba at the Center for a New American Security says Beijing and Moscow could get creative and work outside of the international financial system.
There might well be a barter trade where China might provide goods and food and other items that were wanted by the Taliban in exchange for these items.
Ziemba says the Taliban have already been operating under the radar, smuggling drugs across the border. She says it would be impossible for the U.S. to cut that off. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You might have seen in your various glimpses at the news today that Wall Street was way more down than up. And you might have said to yourself, well, yeah, Afghanistan. And you'd have been wrong. Retail sales is what it was about today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A little bit back to where we were in the early days of this pandemic when it comes to hospital capacity and patient loads, or if you put it in the terms this program is most fluent in, supply of beds and staff, trying to keep up with the demand of the number of COVID patients. Intensive care units are filling up again, and some hospitals are suspending non-essential surgeries again. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
At Our Lady of the Lake Regional Medical Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, staffing is a real struggle right now.
The biggest reason is absolutely because more people are in the hospital.
Dr. Catherine O'Neill is chief medical officer at Our Lady of the Lake, and she says the hospital is being overwhelmed, both with COVID patients and people who put off other medical care because of the pandemic.
And so the combination is just a sicker population of people who need more hospital care than they did before.
And she says there are fewer people on staff to take care of all of them, partly because of burnout. A growing number of healthcare workers just can't take it anymore.
We have seen our healthcare providers just move on to non-hospital care venues because they're tired of the pandemic.
And it's almost impossible to find enough new staff because every hospital is competing for the same people.
It's almost like a game of hungry hippo. Only a certain amount of nurses, physical therapists, respiratory therapists, and now everybody's volumes are much higher because of COVID.
Almost every state has at least a few hospitals that are dealing with critical staffing shortages. Dr. Jorge Caballero founded an organization that analyzes COVID data, and he says the problem is most acute in the South and Southwest.
What I'm seeing is states like Alabama, Arizona, Louisiana, Missouri, more than one out of five hospitals are reporting that they have a critical staffing shortage.
And those shortages are getting worse. Some hospitals in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas say they have no more beds in their intensive care units.
It's not just the physical bed. It's actually the staffing that goes along with it. The nursing, the respiratory therapy, the pharmacists, and the physicians.
There is no quick fix. In the past, when demand spiked at hospitals, maybe during a bad flu season, they could staff up quickly by hiring a bunch of temporary nurses. But now,
there's not as many of those temporary nurses to go around because every hospital needs them.
Kavita Patel is a primary care doctor in Washington, D.C., and a fellow at the Brookings Institution. She says every hospital she's ever worked at has been short-staffed to some degree, but never like this.
The shortages go all the way down the line, even to custodial staff. You know, you never realize how much you desperately need custodial staff until you have to turn around a COVID room.
At hospitals around the country, patients are feeling the backlogs. They're waiting longer in the emergency room to be seen, and in some cases, longer at home for an ambulance to come when they dial 911.
It's a very challenging situation.
Jared Kosin is president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. He says when a hospital is really short-staffed and can't hire all the nurses and doctors it needs,
there are other maneuvers you take to meet demand. You know, one of the first stops is canceling procedures and then redeploying those staff. So if you need people working on ventilators, you know, cancel surgeries and redeploy anesthesiologists, assistants, so on and so forth.
Just the other week, Kosin says the hospitals in Anchorage had to do that, cancel non-essential surgeries for a few days to relieve some of the pressure. And if COVID keeps surging, he worries things could get even worse.
You hear about other markets, you know, Louisiana and other states, and I don't want to be in a position where we're having press conferences at our facilities saying there's no more beds available. That can be avoided.
But the only way it can be avoided, Kosin says, is if a lot more Alaskans get vaccinated soon. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
I don't know if you knew this. Seems like it's been a while since I've mentioned it, but we've got a podcast. If you miss us on the air, check it out, would you? Coming up.
There's not enough women who know about this work.
Okay, but why? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 282 points today, 0.7%, closed at 35,343. The NASDAQ down 137, about 0.9%, finished at 14,656. The S&P 500 sagged 31.7%, 44.48 there. So checking some big retailers. After Mariel's story, Gap lost more than 4%. Bed Bath & Beyond and Hanes brands down about 3.5% apiece. Target, which reports earnings tomorrow, dipped 3.2%. 499 and 5A. The first item is a price in dollars. The second is a model number for the new Pixel phone. Google's entry-level device launches August 26th. Parent company Alphabet declined 1.1% today. Bonds basically stable. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 1.26%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are just shy of a year and a half of working from home, for those of us lucky enough to be able to do that. And just as things started looking like there might be some kind of back-to-the-office momentum building, the Delta variant is changing corporate minds and accelerating a rethinking of office real estate. State Street, the big international asset management company, is the latest. Said this week it's going to close its offices in New York City entirely. Other companies are pushing their start dates farther into the fall, BlackRock and Wells Fargo among them. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab takes stock of what's happening in business districts and the ripple effect outside of those tall office towers.
So the ripple effect has three stages. The first, of course, is the actual pebble plunked into the water. That's how many people are physically going to work. The average office occupancy in the U.S. right now is about 30%. That's according to JLL, a commercial real estate firm. And it likely won't jump too high anytime soon. Ben Breslow is JLL's chief research officer.
We've seen some companies push those dates back, either to October or some of them back to January.
January, which brings us to the pebble's first ripple, all the restaurants and retail stores that rely on in-person office workers.
Having the return to office pushed back a bit further, you know, will mean it'll be a little longer for that recovery.
He guesses sometime into 2022. And this has a lot of people thinking about whether business districts that so heavily identify as corporate neighborhoods work anymore.
Well, the pandemic really revealed the ecosystem of a downtown.
Michael Edwards is president of the Chicago Loop Alliance.
So everything's connected, right? There's no workers, and then the restaurants depart. And when there's no restaurants, people are saying, why should I come back downtown to work?
But when businesses move out, other businesses and people can move in to live, study, or play. That would be a win for the final ripple in the pond, cities themselves. Because Edwards says when you add up sales tax, property taxes, and parking tickets, Chicago's business district, the Loop, accounts for almost a third of the city's tax revenue.
In most cities, they're the economic driver of the city's budget, and therefore they need to be protected if the city is going to survive.
Chicago's made some progress. There are now about twice the number of people living in the Loop than there were a decade ago. But Edwards says the city has to diversify more to cope with the changing nature of office work. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
$1.9 million people passed under the close and watchful eye of the Transportation Security Administration yesterday. We are pretty consistently in the high 1-point-something million people getting on planes every day now. And that's great for airlines and all the related and dependent aviation industries. Not so great, though, for the environment, because all those planes means a whole lot of greenhouse gases. But what, then, is an eco-conscious traveler to do? Buying carbon emission offsets to counteract the impact of all that flying is one popular option. But as Marketplace's Amanda Peacher reports, those offsets might not deliver on their promise.
Before the pandemic, Laura Iverson in Portland, Oregon, was often jetting away somewhere for a weekend trip. But climate change is making her rethink that. During one of the recent heat waves in the Pacific Northwest, it was sometimes 100 degrees inside her house.
I had to put 3 of my 4 pets in the tub in cold water and wash them down. They were so hot.
That's 3 cats and 1 chihuahua. Iverson plans on flying less now, but she really wants to visit her baby niece this fall.
Her name is Juliet, and she lives in Philadelphia.
Iverson will buy carbon offsets for her flight. The idea is people or companies can offset their own greenhouse gas emissions by paying toward projects that reduce emissions somewhere else. Think planting trees or new wind energy development.
From Portland, Oregon.
Iverson lets me sit in virtually while she shops online for carbon offsets.
To Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
One site calculates her share of that flight's footprint.
0.9 of a ton of carbon emissions.
But on another site, it's much higher.
It's saying an entirely different number for how much carbon it estimates.
Some organizations let you pick the kind of offset project you want to fund.
So that would be the equivalent of buying 32 urban trees.
This voluntary carbon offsets market is unregulated. There's no standard price tag for 1 ton of carbon emissions. And the cost to offset Iverson's flight is different on 4 websites.
From $7.73 up to probably $34.
One reason for that is that there are many kinds of offset projects, and paying to upgrade cook stoves in Sudan is probably a lot less expensive than, say, brand new technology that sucks carbon emissions out of the atmosphere. Danny Cullenward with the research nonprofit Carbon Plan says the prices in the market are just not high enough to make a difference.
$1 or $5 or even $10 a ton. The idea that we can cheaply offset our way to carbon neutrality at the price points you see in these markets is just a complete joke.
A European Union study from 2016 looked at a broad group of carbon offset projects and found that 85% of them were probably not making good on their promises to reduce emissions. Nancy Young with the trade organization Airlines for America says some past criticisms of carbon offsets were justified, but standards are different now.
That verification and validation process that's in place for airline carbon emissions reductions and offsets is very solid today.
But it's hard to measure the real effects of these projects, says Barbara Haya, who studies offsets at UC Berkeley. Take a project that pays someone not to cut down trees.
When you pay a landowner not to harvest their land, how do you know that they would have harvested their land?
Maybe they were not planning to cut down their trees. Haya says this is especially a problem for the growing number of companies using offsets to hit net zero emissions.
What scares me the most about offsets is that it creates the fiction that we don't need to reduce our emissions and all we need to do is buy cheap credits off of the market.
What would really help, Haya says, is flying less and driving less and shrinking our carbon footprint in other ways. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
One of the things President Biden's trying to do in this economy is to increase the number of apprenticeships available. 1 to 2 million more training slots for the trades, plumbers and carpenters, electricians, which can turn into well-paid blue-collar jobs. Thing is, in the industry where most of those jobs are, which is construction, women are just 4% of the workforce, and it's been that low since the 1980s. So from KPCC here in Los Angeles, Jill Replogle went to find out why.
The morning workout for six women hoping to break into construction looks uncomfortable.
Here we go. When I count, you say
1,000.
1,000.
They're in jeans, long-sleeve shirts, and work boots, doing squats while curling 30-pound cinder blocks. This pre-apprenticeship training program is put on by the nonprofit WINTER, that stands for Women in Non-Traditional Employment Roles. It's one of just a few programs across the U.S. that specifically helps women prepare for construction apprenticeships. The training is free, and it's intense to get these women ready for a physically demanding job that's competitive and overwhelmingly dominated by men. Getting into an apprenticeship can be a long road, and not necessarily a welcoming one for women. Retired electrician Meg Vasey knows firsthand. She says she was one of just eight women in her Northern California union when she joined in 1981. She now runs a training and advocacy organization called Tradeswomen, Inc.
They insisted upon calling me Brother Vasey because it was the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, so there were no sisters.
Here's a sampling of what she faced on the job.
I was told all the time that I was taking a man's job and that I had no right to be there. So when I woke up in the morning and walked into my job site and opened up the game box where all the tools were, there would be big hustler displays.
Vasey thinks she never would have gotten interviewed for the apprenticeship if it weren't for an executive order that set goals for federal building contractors to increase the number of women employees. Today, women make up just 9% of federally registered apprenticeships, and most of them are in industries that pay less than construction, according to government data. Vasey says there are likely multiple reasons the number of women in construction has remained so low.
You know, I do think there's not enough women who know about this work.
There's also implicit bias among employers. Some might think women can't handle the job physically. And sexual harassment and bullying on job sites. Vasey and others say, as it stands, getting into a skilled trade is almost like a family secret.
Friends, brothers, and in-laws. Those are the men who get in as well on a regular basis into construction.
Pre-apprenticeship programs like WINTER provide an alternative route, especially for women and people of color. The six women in this cohort range from 24 to 52 years old. There's a photographer whose work dried up during the pandemic, a host at an Outback steakhouse. Diana Lanton is 31. She currently works as a server at a bar to pay the bills for her and her 11-year-old daughter. Lanton says she's always been a tinkerer.
Me, for my birthdays and, like, especially, like, Christmas, when I have, like, my list of what I want, I'm like, tools.
33-year-old Janelle Herrera works as a project manager in telecommunications. And after being laid off twice in the last 4 years, she hopes a union job in construction will be more stable.
I don't want to have to worry, how am I going to help my kid?
Besides construction training, these women also learn life skills, like how to nail a job interview. There's also a case manager who helps with things like finding childcare and housing. The ultimate goal is to land an apprenticeship and become a journeywoman. That comes with benefits and among the best salaries you can earn without a high school diploma. In some parts of the country, plumbers make $45 an hour or more. After decades of minimal progress getting women into the trades, Vasey, the former electrician, says she now sees more hope than she has in a long time. In Los Angeles, I'm Jill Replogle for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a little bit of behind the scenes on how we decided to do Nancy Marshall Genzer's story about isolating the Taliban from the financial system. There was a Twitter thread yesterday from a guy by the name of Ajmal Admati, who until he left the country was the head of Afghanistan's central bank. It's kind of gripping, actually, the story about how he got out and then what he thinks is going to happen to the Afghan economy. Anyway, we tried to get him on this program, but our colleague at the BBC, Victoria Craig, got him first, beat us to it. Here is just a couple of excerpts from their interview.
I think the economic situation will deteriorate. We were able to maintain macroeconomic stability even as provinces were falling, even during that last week. But there's a number of factors that I think are going to lead to a worsening of the situation.
The freezing of Afghanistan's international reserves was one of the things he mentioned. Nancy talked about that. Also, though, this.
I would expect donor flows to significantly decline over the next few months. And that's going to cause pressure on the currency to depreciate. And that's in turn going to lead to higher inflation, pressure on the banking sector, and likely increases in poverty rates.
Ajmal Admati is his name. He's the head of the Afghan Central Bank in exile, I guess you should say. More of his interview tomorrow on the global edition of the Marketplace Morning Report, hosted out of the BBC in London by Victoria Craig, or online if you miss it on the air. All right, we got to go. No moment of economic context today. Got to find your own. I just talked too much, I suppose. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.